OCT has revolutionized the treatment of eye disease on a global basis, and it is now routinely used to make clinical decisions about treating patients with blinding diseases such as macular degeneration, diabetic retinopathy, and glaucoma.
That's Dr. Carmen Pugliafito speaking about medical technology he invented. Pugliafito is a top eye surgeon who served as dean of USC's Keck School of Medicine from 2007 until last year. Under his tenure, the school's U.S. News and World Report ranking improved. He hired more than 70 professors. He oversaw $200 million in research grants, and he estimates he attracted more than $1 billion in donations. But Pugliafito lived a double life, one laced with methamphetamine and other illegal drugs, and an overdose of a 21-year-old woman, a prostitute who says she was his near-constant companion for a year and a half. That's according to an investigation out today from the LA Times. Reporter Paul Pringle joins me now to talk about it. Hi there.
Hi.
All right. So tell us more about Dr. Pugliafito, and how did he become dean of the USC Medical School?
He had a very distinguished career over many years. He was previously held leadership positions at the University of Miami and Tufts University. And he was hired on the basis of that, and also for his fundraising ability.
Mm-hmm. And his salary, I understand, was over $1 million a year?
Yeah, that's according to USC's tax returns.
Okay. So your investigation showed him in some really compromising situations. There are photos and videos that you did not publish on the newspaper's website, but you reviewed them, and they provided the backbone to your story. Tell us about what's in those.
They do show him, in some occasions, using drugs, smoking what experts told us was methamphetamine. People who did this with him also told us that, and you know, it's pretty compelling stuff.
Right. And one of those people is a woman named Sarah Warren. Who is she?
She's a 22-year-old who lives in Huntington Beach. She fell into a life of drugs and prostitution briefly, and she's now in recovery and has been for quite some time. And we were able to persuade her to come forward and tell us what she told us.
And she told you that she was his companion, near constant, she said, for a year and a half?
Yes.
And so how was he able to be with her for a year and a half and then also run the USC Medical School and do all that fundraising?
Well, that's something we're still looking into.
Okay. And so what does she say happened during that
year? Well,
again,
they spent a great deal of time together, almost constantly, and their relationship was largely built around drugs, methamphetamine, heroin, GHB, the so-called date rape drug.
Uh-huh. And so there was an incident that you described in the paper, if you could recount it for us on the radio, where she actually overdoses. And this is in a hotel in Pasadena?
Yes, it was the Hotel Constance. It was on March 4, 2016. I got a tip that it occurred. That's when I began to look into Dr. Pugliafito, and that eventually led to the story.
Mm-hmm.
But she overdosed at the hotel. There was no police report filed apart from a call for service log. And she was taken to the local hospital. She did recover. And then according to her, they went back to the hotel and continued to use drugs.
After she OD'd? After she was in the hospital?
That's what she told us, yes.
Okay. So after that, he resigns 3 weeks after the overdose.
Yes, he did.
And what was the reason for his resignation?
At the time, he told us that he had an opportunity in the private sector he wanted to pursue, and that's why he gave up the deanship.
And what did USC tell you?
USC hasn't communicated with us at all, except to say that they have no comment. We did try many times to speak to them.
Okay, they sent us a very brief statement. I'll just read it. It says, the university is not at liberty to discuss personnel matters, which by law are confidential. However, we can confirm that following Carmen Pugliafito's resignation as dean of the medical school in March 2016, he was on sabbatical from his faculty position. The university is following all proper procedures to review his status in patient care. If the assertions reported in the July 17th Los Angeles Times story are true, we hope that Carmen receives care and treatment that will lead him to a full recovery. So your, to your knowledge so far, USC didn't have any knowledge that this was going on, that he was abusing drugs at the time?
USC has not communicated with us. There's no way for me to know that.
Okay. So what has happened since he resigned?
The school continued to list him as a faculty member, and he was the website said he remained available for medical appointments. He did maintain his relationship with the young woman for some months after he resigned.
And I understand he actually represented USC at an event this past weekend at the Langham.
Yes, he did.
Have you had any reaction since the story was published from him, his associates?
No, I have not.
And what does this tell you, sort of in the larger, pull back a little bit, what does this tell you about anything about USC, about the fundraising, about the lives of men like him?
Well, again, we're continuing our reporting. I don't know if I could comment on that sort of larger issue yet, but it's something we're looking into.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you so much for your reporting and for being on the air today.
Thank you.
Paul Pringle, Los Angeles Times reporter. He specializes in investigating corruption. He investigated this story along with several other journalists at the LA Times. You can check out the story at the LA Times website. Coming up, Donald Trump has declared this Made in America Week, but his daughter's company makes all its products overseas. Ivanka Trump handbags, dresses, and shoes are made in places like Bangladesh, where workers work long hours for pennies. That story is next on Press Play.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Today is officially the beginning of Made in America Week at the White House. This is a theme that President Trump has been talking about since his inauguration when he said this.
Buy American and hire American.
But according to an investigative report from the Washington Post, as he stood on stage talking about the dangers of outsourcing production overseas, a container ship was pulling into Long Beach carrying 500 pounds of foreign-made Ivanka Trump brand blouses. That's just a fraction of the millions of Ivanka Trump products that have been imported into America from factories in Bangladesh, Indonesia, China, and other countries. They're made by workers making low wages. Those workers are mainly women. Ivanka has made women's empowerment part of her lifestyle brand and her role at the White House. But the Post found that her company lags behind many others in the apparel industry when it comes to the treatment of workers in those factories. Drew Harwell is a business reporter at the Washington Post, and he joins us now. Hi.
Hey.
All right. So Made in America Week is all about buying products made in America. And that, of course, was a big talking point during the campaign on the part of Donald Trump. But you found in your reporting that all of Ivanka Trump's products are made overseas. Nothing is made here?
Nothing. None of the clothes, none of the shoes, none of the handbags, nothing that has Ivanka Trump's name on it is made in the U.S. And that's kind of a big deal. I mean, not just for the sort of contrast that it has with what the White House is urging is its campaign pledge for every other company. But, you know, it says something about the challenge for a company to make in the U.S. And in a lot of cases, it's really difficult for these companies to make things in the U.S. for prices that American shoppers want to pay.
Right. So where are the factories located and what are the working conditions like?
We traced Ivanka Trump's goods back to five countries: India, Indonesia, Bangladesh, Vietnam, and China, the main one. And, you know, some of these factories seem like they're good, but some of them have, you know, issues where there is low pay for the workers, almost always very exceedingly low pay at the minimum wage, sometime below. Conditions where workers feel like they're verbally abused by supervisors if they don't work fast enough. And just sort of some of the basic conditions of, you know, workers having to live apart from their children because they can't afford to have their kids live with them in factory housing. And, you know, some workers who feel like they want to agitate for better wages feel like there's maybe a culture of repression or retaliation. Some workers, you know, in places like Bangladesh where there is a culture of worker crackdowns have been arrested, have, you know, faced surveillance. these sorts of issues that you see. And so, and it's not just Ivanka Trump's brand that has to deal with this, but the fact that she is in the White House, you know, traveling the world on this mission of, you know, family work-life issues, women's issues in the workplace, it raises the question of why is it so different in her, you know, public policy life than it is in her private business life.
Right. And one of her lines or one of her hashtags taken from her book is women who work. So she is definitely promoting her brand as good for working women.
I started this company for women who inspire me.
Hi.
Hi.
Modern, passionate women who work. The women I know who are working today.
Hi.
Hi.
Are working hard to create and build the lives that they want to live. And there's nothing more compelling and powerful than that.
And yet when it comes to these women who are working in the factories, perhaps their working conditions leave a lot to be desired.
That's exactly right. And yeah, in these workplaces, it's a predominantly female workforce in manufacturing in China and Bangladesh and Vietnam. They, you know, these are women who may have come from the village or live in the city, and, you know, they see these jobs as a lifeline. It's certainly a work that they can contribute to life at home, but they also, you know, have to deal with verbal abuse and low pay and all of these issues that face them and that are so such a world apart from, you know, the very glamorous, very, you know, empowered lifestyle that Ivanka Trump is pushing forth as kind of her business mission.
Now, she didn't comment on this directly for your article, but might her argument or her defense be that she contracts out with an apparel manufacturer who then subcontracts out to these factories? So she isn't directly responsible. Would that be her defense?
Absolutely. Yeah. And her company says that. Her company says that they have very high standards for who they work with, that they take these things really seriously. But there's a lot of things that the Ivanka Trump company has not done that similar companies of bigger size, smaller size, companies that are younger and older, that deal with a lot of clothing manufacturing overseas, those companies have done things like paying for independent inspections of these factories, being a little more hands-on with knowing where the work gets done and how their workers are treated. So, you know, the question becomes why has the Ivanka Trump company so far not made the choice to invest in things like independent inspections? These are things that the company now says they intend to do, that they're working toward doing in the future. But, you know, the company has been around for a couple of years, and these would be, you know, really important protections that the workers could see overseas.
So what is it that she could do, especially from her position as someone in the White House? What is it that she could do fairly easily that might go a long way to helping these workers?
You know, Ivanka's people say that she is in a tough position because she's in the White House as an advisor to her father, the president. She feels like she's in maybe a tough position because she has to be independent of the company, and yet she still owns the company. These are issues that are still really important to, you know, not just her personal finances, but the company's finances. But a lot of the, you know, labor activists and sort of industry experts we've talked to have said, you know, if the company were to ask its supplier to, you know, make the names of the factories public, to share details of, you know, the conditions, the pay, the labor standards for some of these workers overseas, that could be a really good deterrent of some of the bad things you see and some factories that are not just Ivanka's, but, you know, used by other brands. And a lot of companies, I mean, companies like Levi Strauss and lots of big clothing companies, you can see down to the address where these factories are, how many people work there, what they're paid. So, I mean, transparency can go a long way. But right now, there's so little we know about the factories that Ivanka Trump's companies use that you just have to ask, I mean, what are the conditions there and how are workers being treated?
Right. And you and your colleagues actually had to get Freedom of Information Act requests in and look at databases and travel to these countries to interview workers. The company, Ivanka Trump's company, didn't give you this information.
Yeah, no, Ivanka Trump's company did not share any of the factories' names with us. They say they have a code of conduct that they keep the factories to, but they won't publish it. There was not a lot of information given from their side. What we had to do was we used U.S. custom records of all the containers that come into the country. We used data services that track these big cargo ships to see which ports they left, where they were along the journey, and where they arrived. And we kind of had to piece together sort of the supply chain of, you know, they end up in American stores, but where do they start? Where are the factories where they're being produced? So, you know, it was difficult. And this is kind of the global modern economy that we work in. There's not a ton of presumed transparency for these private companies to share where all of the things that we buy every day, every year, get made. So, you know, this was a challenge. And, you know, I think what we found underlines, you know, the difficulty and, you know, really knowing that the workers who make the things that we depend on are treated fairly.
And despite the fact that Nordstrom dropped her line because it wasn't profitable or making money for the stores, is it profitable now? Is she making money off it?
So her company won't share exact numbers. They say that revenues were up last year. They say that revenues are doing really well this year, and that they have a whole new audience. It used to be this, you know, their target market used to be urban, professional, women who work, and now it's taken on sort of the shine of the politics that are surrounding it. So there's maybe more of an audience that appreciates the Trump politics. They are now maybe Ivanka Trump customers. How profitable they are, we don't really know, but they say that the business is doing really well. So we have to kind of take them at the word on that.
Drew Harwell is a business reporter for The Washington Post, where you can read his investigative piece on Ivanka Trump's line. Thank you so much, Drew.
Thank you.
And we want to hear from you. Is it important for you to try to buy American or to buy from companies that verify ethical practices overseas? You can let us know on Facebook or Twitter at KCRW Press Play. Let's talk more about ethics involving the Trump White House and its private businesses and how the two may co-mingle with Loyola Law School professor Jessica Levinson, who is our regular Monday Legal Eagle.
Thank you for having me. An expert on commingling now. Thank you, Trump administration.
Commingling. That seems so friendly. So the head of the ethics division, the top ethics watchdog, his name is Walter Schaub. He gave the New York Times an interview, which was, well, quite fiery. He actually said that the United States is, quote, close to a laughing stock when it comes to ethics, thanks to the Trump White House. What else did he say?
I don't think there was a lot of sugarcoating going on. And Mr. Schaub has actually been a longtime critic of Mr. Trump. So right around the inauguration, he started tweeting that Trump needed to divest of his assets and his business holdings. And he basically started saying what a lot of people said, which is, Mr. Trump, you're not acting like any other previous president. You're keeping your businesses. You handed them over to your sons, but you're still very much, you're going to be aware of what's happening, and you can still profit from those businesses. And that's kind of the crux of what a lot of Mr. Schaub's proposals for change have been, which is, you know what, this worked well for 40 years because we had men who adhered to certain norms, even if they weren't legally required to. So for instance, every prior president in modern history put their assets in a blind trust. Mm-hmm. So they didn't know if they could profit off of certain dealings. That's very different from what President Trump has, where he has his family running things. And he is, by the way, visiting family-owned businesses.
Which he did over the weekend with another golf club visit.
Which he does almost every weekend. And so what people are basically concerned about here is the president using his office to personally financially profit? I mean, there's,
because every time he spends time at one of these golf clubs that he owns, he gives it publicity.
He gives it publicity. And by the way, the taxpayers are paying for all of these trips for him and his family, for protection, for travel. And so in very real ways, we know that the family business is benefiting from his position as president. Other presidents have said, let's draw a really big fat line between me and my businesses. President Trump seems to treat his his ability to benefit his businesses as kind of a perk of the job. And that's deeply concerning to a lot of people.
So what can he do now? He's outgoing. He's firing up the Twitter sphere and, you know, burning down the house as he leaves. But what can he do now?
This is what we call a loud exit. Yeah. He's not going quietly into the night, and he's going to work for a nonprofit that, frankly, I think will continue to sue the Trump administration for ethical issues. So what he can do is he said, I want to work with the House Oversight Committee, and I want to try and draft legislation that makes the Office of Governmental Ethics both more powerful and more independent. So he says, I want subpoena power. I want to change disclosure laws. I want to say you have to do what every other president other than Trump has done, which is disclose your tax returns. I want there to be deeper disclosure. I want there to be, basically it all kind of boils down to, I want the Office of Governmental Ethics to be more robust, and I want there to be more conflicts of interest.
And who would make that so? Congress?
So Congress would have to make that so.
Okay, let's move on now to another question that people have had, and that is, what with Donald Trump Jr. and his legal entanglements and problems, he's had to hire a lawyer. Can the campaign, the Trump campaign, pay for that lawyer, that legal counsel?
Yes. If it's related to campaign activity, then the campaign absolutely can, and this is very clear, they can pay for a lawyer for Donald Trump Jr. Now, I know there was a lot of discussion about the fact that disclosure indicates that Donald Trump Jr.'s lawyer was actually hired about 2 weeks before the news broke that he had this meeting, which clearly would necessitate obtaining legal counsel. But it's not clear to us now why this lawyer was hired 2 weeks before, who he was representing. And I think it's important for everyone to know there's a lot of ethical problems related to the Trump administration, but using campaign funds to hire a lawyer related to campaign activity is simply not one of them. That's absolutely permissible.
Okay. Finally, something we talked about with you on this show before, the California bar exam is really, 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 really hard.
I remember last time we discussed this, you said, it's really hard, comma, and you passed.
Well, I was impressed because according to this article I read, the last time that the exam was given in February, only, 34.5% of people who took it passed.
Well, the February bar exam tends to have lower pass rates because those are typically people who are second-time test takers, because most people graduate from law school in May, they have a great 3 hours of celebrating their graduation, and then literally the next morning they start their bar review courses. And then they take the July exam. So the February exam has always had lower numbers, but certainly California's numbers are going down. And now it looks like the California Supreme Court is going to step in and say, we have authority over this area and we're going to exert it. And we're going to tell you it should be easier to pass the California bar exam.
Why would they want it to be easier?
They want it to be easier because they think that a lot of qualified people who went to law school who would be good lawyers are prevented from being able to practice law. And I think this brings up a larger conversation that actually a lot of states are having, which is they're trying to make the bar more uniform. And people are doing, the more important thing is they're thinking more deeply about, how do we make sure that there's baseline proficiency? How do we make sure that you're going to be a decent lawyer before we unleash you on the masses? And the bar exam, frankly, regardless of what the score is that you need, it's not a great way of doing that. I mean, I would never say to someone, I had this problem, let me tell you in one paragraph, and now in 30 minutes, without looking at a single thing, tell me whether or not I'm going to win. And that's basically what the bar exam does. It tests test taking.
Mm. And you could argue that's the case with all standardized testing.
Oh, absolutely. This is not special to the bar exam. And there's an argument as to either, if we lower it, then will we lower the standards such that there will be unqualified people who will be unleashed on all of us and who will be, you know, on the back of buses with, like, did you have an accident?
Please call. Or you could argue we have enough of those anyway. So
we do
maybe
have
the tough bar exam didn't prevent that at all.
That's the question. Does the difficult bar exam make sure that we're getting good lawyers, or does it make sure that we're getting people who know how to pass the bar exam becoming lawyers?
And we need more lawyers.
And that's an existential question that I can't answer.
Do we need more lawyers?
Always.
I think we all have our own answer to that. Jessica Levinson, the law professor and lawyer that we do need. She teaches at Loyola Law School and joins us every Monday here on Press Play. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, let's hear from you. Have you taken the California bar exam? Did you pass the first time like Jessica did? You can weigh in on our Facebook or Twitter page at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, the twin sister of a woman shot and killed along with a friend by Inglewood police, still looking for answers about what happened.
So the two unconscious people end up dead, and all of a sudden trying to make it seem like they did something wrong and try to bring out their backgrounds that has nothing to do with their death. And the fact that the five officers has been fired, that shows a lot.
How a young mother and her friend ended up dead as they sat in a car. That story next on Press Play.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Keisha Michael was in a car with her friend Mark Quentin Sandlin last year. They were in Inglewood. It was about 3 o'clock in the morning. Police surrounded the car. Apparently, they tried to wake the couple. And here's how Inglewood Mayor James Butts described what happened next to KNBC TV.
The officers retreated, isolated the vehicle, and spent about 45 minutes attempting to rouse the occupants and to de-escalate the situation.
The situation did not de-escalate. Officers shot and killed Keisha and Mark Quentin. 13 bullets hit Keisha, 7 Mark Quentin. In May of this year, Inglewood Mayor Butts announced the five officers involved were no longer with the department. But the mayor and the Inglewood PD have refused requests for more details. Keisha's twin sister, Trisha, has been looking for those answers. Her family has also filed a civil lawsuit against the city of Inglewood. They plan to go into mediation this week. I spoke with Trisha late last week.
Hi, how you doing?
Great, thank you. Also joining us, the family's attorney, Milton Grimes. Welcome to you, sir.
Thank you for having me.
Trisha, on February 21st of last year, you and your sister went to a baby shower, and after that, she went to another party with her friend. And so when did you sense that something went wrong?
Early that morning after work, going home and calling her, and she's not answering her phone. It's not like her. She usually answers her phone. The kids was at a babysitter, so I know that the next morning she's quick to call a babysitter and get her baby. That was awkward to me. When I'm calling, she's not answering. Then I call his phone, he don't answer. I'm calling the babysitter, and she's like, no, I haven't heard from her. I felt something really all through that night, but just hoping that she's okay. That's what made me call the next morning.
So what was your understanding after you left her? Where was she going? What was she doing?
She was going to a friend's, their mother's birthday party.
And then how did you find out what happened to her?
My mom called me, not till the next day, until like 5 that evening. Investigators came to the house saying that they found her body in the car and that they don't know what happened and that they're still investigating.
And let me bring you in, Mr. Grimes. What, this chain of events, what does this tell you?
This tells me that there is a serious lack and respect for human life by the Inglewood Police Department. The witnesses that we've talked to stated that Keisha Michael's body laid on the street until after 1 p.m. that following day. She was killed between 3 and 4 o'clock a.m. They did not remove her body for over 10 hours. We see no need, no reason, no respect from them to do that. So that's what this tells me. That the amount of shots that we hear were made, so over 50 shots from various police officers in this situation, is just unacceptable.
And did she carry a gun at all?
No, she'd never owned a gun. Never
did her friend carry a gun?
From what I heard, yeah, but her, no.
Is there any indication, Milton Grimes, that he may have pulled out his gun, that there was some kind of exchange of gunfire?
No. I'm in sort of a conflict situation in that I can't disclose to you certain confidential information that has been provided to me by the defense, the city of Englewood. But based upon our information and the reaction of the police department, there's no evidence that either one of them ever put a gun in their hand.
Tricia, so you went to the Oversight Commission, the Police Oversight Commission in Englewood, for answers. Did you receive any?
No, just the mayor saying 30 days and the next 30 days, another 30 days, and just stalling us, basically.
Let me add this. Mm-hmm. I think the fact that five officers were terminated from the Englewood Police Department speaks volumes for something wrong happening out there that morning.
But it took a while for them to be terminated.
Yes, it took a whole year. Just us going up there protesting, going to the city council, different activism like Black Lives Matters and stuff coming in and trying to find answers. People in the community in Englewood, the churches, everybody's been to Englewood City Commission trying to figure out like what happened to these two couple that was in a car. And the mayor himself said that they was unconscious. How did they become unconscious? How do two unconscious people end up dead? And all of a sudden trying to make it seem like they did something wrong and try to bring out their backgrounds that has nothing to do with their death. And the fact that, like the lawyer said, the five officers has been fired, that shows a lot, you know, something we've been wanting for the last year and a half. Like, these people should not have been nowhere in the police facility at all. They should have been fired from when that situation happened. We don't know if they was on leave. We don't know nothing. They could have probably been in the streets for all we know. This could have happened to somebody else. They was only with the Englewood Department for a year and a half, I'm hearing. So these was all rookies. Now that they're fired, where are they? Did y'all place them somewhere else?
Were you given any information as to why they were fired, when they were fired?
No, we still don't know up to right now. But the fact that the discovery is coming out, and to me, it seems like they effed up. You know, the mayor is trying to cover him and the chief, and the chief have not even spoke to us about what happened.
And Milton Grimes, from what you can tell us, and I know, as you said, a lot of this is confidential information that is coming out in discovery, but from what you can tell us, why did the mayor make the decision when he did, a year later, to fire these five officers? Because he hasn't stated a reason publicly.
You have to ask Mayor Butts that it took 15 months from February 21st, 2016 to come to the conclusion that they did. I don't think it should have taken that long. I think that the answers were there much earlier than that based upon my reading of documents and just my experience. So why they take that long, I don't know. But the ultimate result was they must have found that these officers did something wrong. But you should ask Mayor Butts that.
Well, we've tried to, and he's refused to comment.
Okay.
So you are representing the family in a lawsuit against the city. What are you seeking?
The only thing that they can do now is pay this family monetary damages. They can't bring their loved one back. They can't bring these three boys' mother back. They can't bring Trisha's sister back or Mrs. Osler's daughter back. So the only thing that you can get in a lawsuit is some monetary compensation. Hopefully we get some change in practice and policy of the police department. Hopefully this case will be utilized to enhance the training and the hiring practice and the selection practice. But I had that dream 25 years ago with Rodney King, and the nightmare is still amongst us. It has not been a vast change in police department practices and procedure since I've been here.
And Tricia, what do you want? What do you want to see happen?
I want to see them prosecuted, and only Jackie Lacey can do that. And so far, all these officers that's done police shooting, none of them have ever been prosecuted. But this is the first for us, for Englewood, to even fire five officers. So if we could make an example out of that and, you know what I'm saying, get it in the mind, if these officers are scared to go in the streets and work in these different cities, they shouldn't be fearful of the people they were protecting, supposedly.
Were these officers white or black or...
I'm not even sure.
Do you know, Milton?
From the people that we talked to who were there and who they were moved away, they brought in an armored vehicle and put it in place beside the car that Krisha and the young man was in. They brought in a car and put it behind their car. They put a police car in front of their car.
To cover it.
They surrounded this car that these two people were in. They had positions of safety, and they have not said one word that these people ever threatened them, ever pointed a gun, fired a gun, or did anything that endangered the policemen's lives. So the public deserves an explanation for why they thought it necessary to shoot this many times or shoot at all in this case.
And so, Tricia, for you, this was your twin sister, and I notice you have a tattoo of her face on your chest, and you're wearing a shirt that says Rest in Paradise, a picture of her. What's your life like now with her not in it?
Like, a piece of me is missing, you know. I was born with her. We slept in the same bed. We dressed alike. We went to school together. We held hands. We talk every day. I have three kids. She has three boys, and, you know, I have to show that love, that support like she has, and my mom, and not able to talk to her every day and planning birthdays. And it's been pretty hard, but the love and support and everybody that's been having my family, been feeling that grief and know that this wasn't right. Her life was taken. Feel like she was assassinated and she wasn't even a terrorist, you know. It's hard to cope with.
I'm really sorry. Really sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
And what is the next step? I understand you're going to be in mediation soon with
yes.
the city.
My mom and her lawyers, they're supposed to do mediation next week, I think. I really don't know much, but I will know sometime next week.
What exactly happened
yes.
and transpired during right. that evening. Milton Grimes, do you think that you'll know concretely what happened? Is there enough evidence to figure out exactly what happened that night?
No, we'll never know the truth unless we have video shots and angles of the video to tell what happened. I'll be hard-pressed to trust whatever the police department said.
They was killed in front of a 7-Eleven, so it's videotapes. It's the fact that, I don't know, the police came and took them. You know, even the people in 7-Eleven said that the police officer pushed them all the way to the back, told them to go in the back. I don't know, for what reason?
And is that something that you can get a hold of?
I'm not sure.
Mr. Grimes?
We're working on it.
On getting that tape?
I can't disclose to you what we do and don't have, so I'm stuck with that. But let me tell you that I've had a case in particular, other than the King case, another video case, where the officer said that the victim attacked them with a handcuff and was going to murder them. Where the victim allegedly was pulling a knife and was going to use it against them. And all of that was refuted by the officer's own cam video on his car. But he lied in the face of the video. Now, he's being prosecuted out in Riverside. So what an officer or these officers say, I've seen it time and time again, is not what you see on camera. I mean, 100% different. So,
what about Jackie Lacey, the city attorney? Do you think that she will look into prosecuting these five officers?
There's been no history of the district attorney's office in L.A. County and in most of these counties prosecuting police officers. So it stands to be seen whether Ms. Lacey will prosecute these officers, but there's a great amount of doubt in the community that she will.
She hasn't prosecuted officers in many years.
Right.
Or there hasn't been a prosecution of police officers. And
she's reelected. So who knows, you know?
Why don't you ask Miss Lacey that question?
We've been trying to do that. She also won't respond. Well, I want to thank you both so much.
Thank you for having us speak on Keisha and Mark Quinton. It's a lot people don't know, and it's saddening that nobody's talking about this. Seven kids with no parents.
That's Tricia Michael, twin sister of Keisha Michael, who died in a police-involved shooting in Englewood last year. Milton Grimes is the lawyer for the Michael family. Coming up, we'll remember the father of the zombie horror flick, George Romero. He was a trailblazer when it came to casting non-white actors. That story is next on Press Play.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
The wave of murder which is sweeping the eastern third of the nation is being committed by creatures who feast upon the flesh of their victims.
The movie Night of the Living Dead started what has become a zombie apocalypse of film and TV shows about dead people coming back to life and eating the rest of us, or at least trying to. George Romero, who made Night of the Living Dead, followed it up with Dawn of the Dead, Day of the Dead, Land of the Dead, Diary of the Dead, and George A. Romero's survival of the dead. He died yesterday of lung cancer. Tony Williams is a professor of film studies at Southern Illinois University and author of the book The Cinema of George A. Romero, Night of the Living Dead, Night spelled with a K, and he joins me now. Hi.
Hi.
Okay, so this movie, Night of the Living Dead, came out in 1968, and until then, horror films were kind of campy and they were suitable for children. What was the reception like for this movie when it came out?
Well, the reception of Night of the Living Dead was devastating for mainstream critics who could not understand Romero using gore in that particular film. But if you have cannibalistic zombies, how do you show them in action? By contrast, the fan community and people seriously interested in the horror film applauded Romero for being a pioneering film director in that particular subgenre of the horror film, and undoubtedly he directed a classic which was very relevant to the time in which it appeared.
Okay, and it was relevant because this was 1968, and the lead was a black actor named Dwayne Jones, the lead character. He's killed by a posse of white guys, and it came out the same year that Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated, but it hadn't been intended to be a racial statement, right? And let me just play a clip of George Romero and what he had to say about that.
When Dwayne agreed to play the role, we didn't change the script. The same things would have happened to him if the actor had been white. The fact that these redneck posse guys shot him, that became racial instead of just a mistaken identity.
So he goes on to say that the idea that the film included a deeper comment on racial issues is really one of the reasons why it became important or seen as important. Is he right about that?
Well, he is, but you have to remember the film was made against the background of the demonstrations against the Vietnam War, the riots in the city, and the casting of Dwayne Jones was one of those happy accidents that happened in independent filmmaking that gave the film a deeper resonance than it already had. And George told me several times that Dwayne Jones was the best actor he had auditioned, and it didn't really matter that he was black, but he was the best actor for the job. And it's very similar to Larry Cohen's comment on Yaphet Kotto in Bone 1972, that he was the best actor for the job. So Dwayne Jones's blackness gave an added resonance to that film in addition to what was already there.
Mm. And this movie was made on a shoestring, right?
Oh, yes. It was by a group of independent filmmakers, colleagues and friends in Pittsburgh who had worked in the television industry and wanted to get together and make a small little feature film.
So how much did it cost for them to make it?
Oh, I don't know the actual economic details, but it was very much shot on a shoestring and it became a breakaway success when it was distributed.
So I understand that has grossed up to now around $50 million. And then, of course, the other films as well have done very well. So how did he look at his legacy in terms of creating this zombie genre?
Well, I think George had mixed feelings about it.
he realized that he'd added a distinctive contribution to the American horror film, but he was also very taken back by the fact that a lot of people were seeing these films for the gore and less for the deep social commentary that he inserted within them.
Hmm. Well, I'm going to play another clip of tape of him talking about the characters in his movies and the fact that they can't stop behaving the way people behave.
Right.
Here he is.
What should matter is that this extraordinary thing is happening, and people are still arguing about upstairs, downstairs, who's the boss? You know, they're still arguing about their own agendas instead of facing the problem. And that's really what all of my zombie films have been about.
So he actually did have some deeper social commentary there.
He certainly did. In fact, he made all his zombie films, as well as his others outside that category, with a deep social conscience. He was very much in the critical tradition of American public intellectuals, and he tried to bring in his criticisms in the popular films that he directed, designed to reach a mass audience, but not in an exploitative manner, but in a meaningful context.
What was he like as a person?
He was very quiet, very modest, very, a sincere, genuine person who very much was never egotistic. In fact, he downplayed his achievements, and when you met him, you felt you were in the presence of a very modest, non-assuming person.
He also did other movies, too, not just zombie films.
Oh, definitely. And these deserve, I think, equal recognition, like Night Riders, the film he made after Dawn of the Dead, which was about a group of medieval jousters putting on the show. And there was an allegory about collective filmmaking and all the fun as well as the pitfalls you have about working in that industry and how it can affect personal relationships. It's a very underrated film.
So how did he feel about working inside and outside the Hollywood studio system?
Well, I think John Carpenter persuaded him to give the Hollywood studio system a try, and George did do some films within the system, but I think he was very deeply dissatisfied at the compromises he had to do, and he looked forward to basically going back to Pittsburgh and then to Canada, where he'd have more control over the films he wanted to do. And one of these little-known independent films made in Canada was Bruiser, about a manipulative yuppie who wakes up one day and finds there's a big mask over his face. It's George's version of that Godfrey Cambridge blaxploitation film Watermelon Man.
Bruiser, it's called.
Yeah, Bruiser.
And I've never seen that. When did it come out?
It came out in 2000. It had a very limited release. George actually ran it at the Film Center in Chicago in 2000. And it's very much a sleeper, but it's got a lot of his social criticism within it that also appears in the zombie films.
All right. Definitely worth checking out as we remember George Romero, who died yesterday. Tony Williams is a professor of film studies at Southern Illinois University and author of the book, The Cinema of George A. Romero, Night of the Living Dead. Tony, thank you so much.
Not at all. Thank you.
And Christian Bordahl is here now.
Hey there.
Not a member of the Living Dead.
I am not a member of the Living Dead. Not yet, anyway. I don't think so. Well, one other person who's a big fan of those films is Edgar Wright, the guy behind Baby Driver.
Oh, because we talked about that last week.
We did indeed. And you will no doubt remember that the first film that really put him on the map was Shaun of the Dead, right, with Simon Pegg.
Yeah, of course.
Another
really funny
zombie film.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So an homage, one might say.
An homage, absolutely. That's what he says on his website today. He wrote a really nice little piece remembering George Romero, saying he made Shaun of the Dead very much with Romero's films in mind. And in fact, the studio put on a personal screening of the film for Romero after he had finished it. And Romero actually, when he made Land of the Dead in 2005, I think it was, 4-5, he gave Wright and Simon Pegg a cameo as zombies in a photo booth in that movie.
Ah, fantastic.
Yes.
So it comes full circle.
Exactly.
All right. Thank you so much, Christian Bordahl. And thank you for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.